Sounds all right now.
Good.
I think that everyone has been served. Most of you have completed your lunch. And I might tell you what it is that you've had for lunch. Yesterday I got a report, hoping it.
Does this work?
Yesterday I got the report that was a little bit garbled, and I never did get the straight of it, but we have 50 head of reindeer on campus for experimental purposes in Dr. Morrison and Dr. Irving's Institute of Arctic Biology. And someone apparently, according to the report I received yesterday, had left them out of their pasturage, and I don't know whether they've been retrieved or not. However, I would report that the stew you just had is reindeer stew. I don't know whether we have any experimental animals left. It was all in a good cause. And a more enthusiastic group of conferees I don't believe I've ever met. At a quarter of 11 last night, they were still asking questions of one another in one of the symposia, and at that time I gave up, and I got back on campus this morning at an indecent hour, and the groups were in session once more. I don't know what it is that Vic Fisher has done to get everyone so aroused about the conference, and maybe it is the reindeer stew that he's prepared here for you. Does that sound like Charlie? I thought so. Would like to introduce the people at the table today. And the person that is on the card that I have here for the extreme right isn't here. He's the treasurer of the Alaska Division of the AAAS, Al George. But in his place is the administrative assistant for the Institute of Social Economics and Government Research, Jim Scott. Jim? Now, they have me confused again. I have the name Irma Duncan, research chemist, Arctic Health Research Laboratory, secretary of the Alaska Division of the AAAS. Where is she? Oh, very good. Very good. Well, now, whom did you put in her place? Now we're back in order. And next is the executive director of the Alaska Legal Services Corporation of Anchorage, William H. Jacobs. Mr. Jacobs. This will be the first riot that we've had, Charlie. The next, of course, is your conference chairman, Victor Fisher, executive director of our research institute. And Mr. John Borbridge, Jr., president of the Central Council of the Tlingit and Haida Indians of Alaska, Anchorage. President of the Center for Community Change, Washington, D.C., Mr. Jack Conway. Professor George Rogers of our Institute of Social, Economic, and Government Research, University of Alaska. Ms. Susan Foster, the Executive Secretary of the Science Conference, whom you met yesterday. And Professor Norman Chance, the Department of Anthropology, University of Connecticut. I understand they had a very rousing meeting this morning in which he was one of the chief speakers. Mr. Richard Hill, Inuvik Research Laboratory, the Northwest Territories. Mr. Hill. Mr. Hill has the distinction of being the immediate past president of the Alaska Division of the AAAS. As always at a conference of this sort, the chairman has a few announcements to make. Mr. Fisher.
I have no medals to hand out today. I only want to announce that at 4:45 p.m. today, we're having the annual meeting of the Alaska Division of AAAS. We hope to conduct the meeting even if some of the sessions are still in progress, which goes counter to all the principles of organizing this conference. The business meeting will be at 4:45 p.m. in room 110, Duck Ring. On the order of business will be a selection of the next theme for the next conference and election of the president and a few other matters of business. All of you are invited to attend.
What would it be on?
Room 110, Duck Ring.
Thank you very much, Vic. A number of firsts for this conference, but chief among them, I think, is the fact that we have with us the president of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. This is a national organization, one of the top such in all of field of professional higher education. And to the best of my knowledge, this is the first time that we have had at a meeting of the Alaska Division the president of the National Association. The National Association now numbers something over 120,000 members, and as such, I think, is among the very largest of our membership groups in higher education. Dr. Bendick Glass, the president, who is here today and will be our luncheon speaker, is a distinguished professor of biology and is academic vice president of the State University of New York at Stony Brook, New York. He's been editor of the Quarterly Review of Biology since 1958 and serves on so many international scientific committees that I can't number them all. He's the past president also of the American Association of University Professors, and tells me he once had the opportunity to do a good turn to the University of Alaska, but I'm not going to bring that up for discussion. The American Society of Naturalists, American Institute of Biological Sciences, Biological Abstracts, American Society of Human Genetics. His publications include more than 200 scientific, professional, and general articles. It is an extraordinarily great privilege for every one of us here at the conference, the 20th Alaska Science Conference, to have with us Dr. Bendick Glass, the president of the AAAS National Organization. Mr. Glass.
Thank you, President Wood. Ladies and gentlemen, I have been extraordinarily interested in the sessions of this conference, which I think is one of the best AAAS meetings that I've ever attended, and which certainly upholds the finest standards of the association. In April of this year, the American Association for the Advancement of Science and the British Association for the Advancement of Science got got together to have a small meeting in Boulder, Colorado, to which about a dozen persons from each of the associations were invited, and about a dozen members, representatives of the scientific public of other other governments and nations. The subject of this conference was science and the future. And it was specifically intended to permit the officers of the several associations for the advancement of science an opportunity to confer together about the kind of work their organization should be doing in the world as we rapidly near the beginning of the 21st century. I was asked to introduce the conference and did so by reversing the theme of the conference itself and by talking not of science in the future, but about the future of science. And I want to reduce for you today a somewhat overlong paper so that you may have the benefit of the thinking that went on at this conference. Your luncheon speaker yesterday, Mr. Stephen Dettinger, was a member of that conference, and what he said yesterday about the exponential rate of change in our society and in science itself presents the theme from which I wish to take off. The overwhelming growth of science in our century and the unceasing dramatic changes in our technology have produced inevitable changes in all aspects of the life of modern man, not the least of which are the changes that must occur in higher education and that continue to worry us educators. I will sketch very briefly the characteristics of the growth of science during the past century and a half, because I believe that the best way to take a look at the future is to back off a bit into the past and see what the trends are which have been developing more accurately within our knowledge. The growth of science during this past century and a half shows certain limiting factors that are now beginning to come into play and emphasize the urgent need for technological assessment and foresight and the consequent intimate relationship between science in the 21st century and the nature of society and of education at that time. 1820. How long ago it seems. Europe was painfully collecting itself after the Napoleonic debacle. In the United States, a new state a year was being carved from the Louisiana Purchase, and President Monroe was considering how best to keep the European powers from intruding further into the new world. India was at length fully in British hands. Australia had a few scattered convict colonies on the coast. Africa, the great unknown continent, was penetrated mainly by Arab slave traders. Even its coasts, except at the Cape of Good Hope, were not yet carved into those colonies that would shape the political map of the world during the 19th century. China and Japan still slumbered behind doors closed to the Western world. Travel was scarcely more rapid than in the days of the Romans. Still depended mainly upon horse, coach, and sail. It required 6 days to make the trip from New York to Washington. Even a letter carried by postal relays took 3 days. My friends usually laugh at this point and say it still takes 3 days. The first railroads were being built in England, but the steam locomotive was in its infancy, and the stagecoach was as rapid, if not as economical. Highway construction had not improved from Roman times. The first steamship to cross the Atlantic Ocean, the Savannah, in 1819, used only auxiliary steam power and portable paddles to supplement her sails, and took 29 days and 11 hours for the crossing, while a fast sailing ship at the same time, though all wooden, required only 20 days, and the record was a mere 13 days and 7 hours for a sailing vessel. There were, of course, no automobiles or airplanes. Communication was as slow as human travel. There was no telegraph, no telephone, no radio. Except for the early use of steam engines in the British mills and mines for turning machinery and pumping water, the sources of power had not changed from ancient times. The windmill, the water wheel, and human and animal labor supplied the basic needs. There was, of course, no electric power or lighting. Illumination at night still depended upon natural oils, the olive oil of the ancients or whale oil from the fisheries. Household heating was shifting from open coal or wood fires to use of the more efficient iron stove, such as the Franklin stove. Although man in northern climes thus tempered the rigors of the winter cold, no one has yet dreamed of attempting to produce artificial coolness during the heat and humidity of the summer. Sanitation was no better than in Roman times, probably nearly everywhere considerably worse. No one, of course, connected the appallingly high infant mortality or the frequent plagues and epidemics which occurred with the spread of germs or parasites. Malaria, the greatest of human killers, was not associated in men's minds with mosquitoes, nor plague with rats and fleas. Only direct contact with diseased persons was recognized as being important to avoid. Nutritional deficiencies commonly went unrecognized as such, although Sir James Cook and others had discovered the importance of fresh fruit in preventing scurvy among sailors. In Spain, the average life expectancy was under 30 years. In England and the United States, it was under 40 years. It was not to begin its phenomenal climb until the second half of the 19th century. No immunization was practiced except through vaccination against smallpox, and vaccination was voluntary and sporadic rather than required. Surgery was necessarily without any anesthesia. Since there was also neither antiseptic nor aseptic surgery, most operations ended in terrible infections followed by death. The population of the world had reached about 1 billion persons. It was growing with particular rapidity in Europe. In 20 years since the first English census, the population of that country had increased by more than 50%. The gloomy doctrine of Malthus was widely accepted. Science in 1820 was virtually limited to Western Europe, with minor participation in Russia, the United States, and elsewhere. In all the world, there were probably fewer than 1,000 persons who thought of themselves as natural scientists. Hardly more than those registered for this convention. There were no regular scientific journals such as Nature or Science. The proceedings of the scientific academies sufficed for publication of new discoveries and reports, or these were incorporated in books. There follows a description of the state of physics and chemistry, of geology and astronomy, and of the biological sciences and mathematics 150 years ago. But we will have to leave that part out because of the pressure of time. I might equally well have chosen the year 1920 to make my point. For the essential characteristic of the scientific and technological change which is occurring is its exponential rate. In many ways, the year 1920 is more similar to the year 1820 than to the year 1970. Take, for example, the world population as one measure. In 1820, about 1 billion. In 1920, an estimated 1.8 billion. In 1970, an estimated 3.6 billion. In the first century, in other words, almost a doubling, not quite, an 80% gain. In the following half century, a full doubling. Take the average life expectancy in the United States as another measure. In 1820, it was about 39 years. In 1920, it was 54 years. In 1970, it will be approximately 71 years. The first century's gain was 15 years in life expectancy. The recent half-century gain was 17 years. Those figures represent the social applications of sulfa drugs and antibiotics, pure milk and water, and universal vitamins to the reduction of infant and childhood mortality. We might go on to compare transportation, communication, entertainment, lots of other aspects of modern life in 1920 with that in 1970. It's hard to realize that only 50 years ago we had no commercial air travel anywhere in the world, no speedy and reliable long-distance telephone service, no radio broadcasting, no television, no movies with sound or color. The increase in scientific and technological work has likewise been exponential, but at an even faster rate than the growth of population or the increase in life expectancy. From about 1750 to the most recent times, the number of journals, scientific journals, has increased by a factor of 10. In every half century, that is, with a doubling time of about 15 years. This increase is by a factor, then, of 1,000 for a century and a half. Derek DeSola Price of Yale University further points out that abstract journals came into existence about 1830, when the number of journals reached a total of 300. And it was consequently no longer feasible for any polymath among scientists to read and digest them all. Hence, a summary of journal contents became necessary. Since that date, the increase in the number of abstracting journals has followed exactly the same rule of increase as for the primary journals, a tenfold increase in every half century. Their number has now also reached the critical number of 300. And there now arises a clamor for abstracts of abstracts. The increases in the number of scientific journals and of abstracting journals, of course, reflect the increase in the number of scientific papers presenting the results of original research. It is probable that at the present time, at least 600,000 papers reporting original research are published each year. Moreover, it is quite clear that the exponential relation has been holding for research papers just as for journals. The number of original research papers published, of course, reflects the number of working scientists at any given time. There's an interesting law that expresses this relationship mathematically. And from that, one can deduce that for every 3 or 3.5 papers, there is one extant author. The number of scientists, in other words, is about one-third the number of scientific papers, whether this be figured on a cumulative basis or taken for a given cross-section of time. 600,000 scientific papers published annually thus corresponds to 200,000 living scientists. Scientists, too, in other words, have been increasing exponentially in numbers over the past 150 years, with a doubling time somewhere between 10 and 15 years. Thus, our United States Census shows a category labeled scientists and technologists as one major professional group, which includes scientists, engineers, and technicians. In 1870, this group, in round numbers, was 12,000 persons. In 1900, 90,000. In 1930, 450,000. In 1950, 1 million. And in 1960, 1.35 million. It's probably now close to 2 million. The curve fits with remarkably little irregularity the exponential expectation for a doubling time of 13 to 14 years. Just another 13 or 14 years, and the number of scientists, engineers, and their technicians double. The scientists proper, those responsible for the production of original research in science, constitute about 11% of the total in this scientists and technologists category. If the scientists who teach in colleges and universities are added in, instead of being counted as teachers, which the census does, there are about one-fifth more, or 13%, of the augmented total. The professional category of scientists and technologists now constitutes about one-fifth, 20%, of the entire professional group in the labor force. Perhaps the upper limit for scientists and technologists might be about 25% of all professional workers. There will continue, I think, to be some need for other kinds of professional workers, you see. We can't have no teachers, no people in health, no people in religion and social welfare, no people in law, arts, letters, and entertainment, and other miscellaneous professions. So that sooner or later, the increase in the number of scientists and technologists is going to reach an upper limit as a proportion of the total in this category of the population. Further increases in absolute numbers would therefore have to arise either from an increase in the size of the total population or a possible increase in the proportion of professional persons in the labor force. The former would not long permit continuation of a faster doubling rate than that of the population itself. Let's remember that in the United States, the general population is doubling at approximately a 70-year interval, or a little less, while the scientists and technologists are increasing at a much more rapid exponential rate than that. Since the total population must in a few decades cease to increase and become stabilized, no great increase in the numbers of scientists and technologists can be expected from this source beyond one or two further doublings. Some increase in the proportion of all professional persons in the labor force might seem to offer a little more hope for a less drastic curtailment in the growth of science. Yet here, too, there seem to be ineluctable limits. To serve adequately in a professional capacity, the equivalent of a college education is widely regarded as the minimum preparation. But very few persons falling into the lower half of the normal distribution of intelligence have sufficient capacity to complete a college program successfully. In other words, we may set a limit for professional competence to include about 50% of the total labor force. At their present rate of expansion, the professional and technical groups have slowly increased from 2.8% of the total labor force in 1870 to over 11% at the present time. Even an increase of professional persons to 20% of the labor force during the decade 1971 to 80 would permit only a 75% increase in the numbers of scientists and technologists. In other words, the examination of these statistics shows very clearly that the present increase in the growth of science cannot continue for more than a very few additional years, perhaps a decade or so. We are clearly at the inflection of the logistic curve that warns us that exponential expansion must halt. The implication of this line of reasoning is that the relatively more rapid increase of scientists and technologists in the population of the United States must soon end. Any increase thereafter can still be great in absolute numbers, but at a maximum it must keep pace with the total growth of the population, which itself is likely in a few decades to reach a saturation point, as I said earlier. And presumably the same conditions will apply to every other country as it reaches the same level of technological development and total density of population. In those nations most highly developed technologically, we've become quite dependent in our economy upon an improvement in technology at a rate of 6 to 7% per annum. But the growth in technology depends upon the growth in scientific understanding and basic knowledge. And if that ceases to grow, can our economy continue to grow at 6 or 7% per annum? Within the next two decades, an 8% annual increase in science is clearly going to move beyond our reach. I've not yet considered the cost of doing scientific work. It is, of course, evident that research costs are increasing far more rapidly than either scientific manpower or productivity. Not merely must we cope with inflation and the problems of an expanding economy amounting to some 3% per year. Far more serious is the increasing cost that comes from the ever more sophisticated and expensive equipment, which scientists in every field must now use if they wish to work at the forefront of knowledge. Some spokesmen of science, including one of the recent president's science advisors, have optimistically advocated a 15% per annum increase in the support of basic science as being needed to match inflationary costs and to equip and support the growing scientific manpower. I think such persons ought to do their arithmetic a little better. Yet such an increase is at an exponential rate greater than any I have cited in this analysis so far. A 15% per annum increase plainly could not continue for more than a few doubling times of 4.7 years, which is what that rate of increase means, without consuming the entire gross national product. The $2 billion of current annual support of basic science in the United States would, for example, in 24 years at a 15% per annum rate of increase, equal the cost of the present defense budget, Vietnam War included, and in 40 years it would exceed the gross national product. Evidently, we are then limited to a very brief growth at any such rate. What seems clearly to be needed, and what is clearly also very lacking in our present science policy, is a full-scale study of the relation of growth in science to technological improvement, to population size and rate of population increase, and to the balanced welfare of other occupations. Studies of population growth show that the logistic curve followed by populations is one of exponential growth with saturation. Inevitably, in a world of finite resources and finite space, limiting factors sooner or later must curb the logarithmic phase of growth, and it gradually diminishes in rate until a maximum or asymptote is reached. Several types of situations may follow. The asymptotic level might be maintained indefinitely, provided the limiting conditions merely restricted further increase. More commonly, there is a negative feedback from the presence of maximum numbers. In a limited space, the waste products of the organisms will tend to accumulate and may exert a toxic effect upon the members of the population. In this case, the population will decline in numbers, and if the environment is not purified, may eventually become extinct. Now, if the growth of science behaves like a growing population of animals or microorganisms, and the evidence I've cited already clearly indicates it does grow in a parallel way, we should be interested in the effort to determine the limiting factors and to forecast the extinction or type of equilibrium most likely to occur. I believe there are at least five major limiting factors well worthy of study, although it's quite impossible in advance of any critical investigation of the action and interplay of these factors to say now what might ensue. The first of these factors is the sheer volume of scientific information that already exists and is so rapidly accumulating. For a scientist to be adequately informed about even his own specialty is almost impossible. I've been informed that many Soviet scientists spend half of each day in reading and studying the literature. Perhaps a phenomenal speed reader can cover, especially with the help of abstracts, as many as 50 articles in a half day at a rate of 10 or 12 per hour. If we then estimate 250 working days in a year, the total he could cover would be 12,500 articles in a year. That seems a respectable amount. Nevertheless, it is barely a tenth of the annual output in either biology or chemistry, and less than the output in most active specialties in these fields. What most American scientists do, I fear, is at the opposite extreme. They frankly surrendered to the impossible and no longer read very much, even in their own fields of work. They do some scanning, on occasion read an important article in full, but for the most part depend upon word of mouth for guidance to the important new work in their specialties. Hence there arise the invisible colleges, which meet annually or semi-annually, membership in which is informal but open only to the elect, since the special purpose of such colloquia is to enable free and roving discussion to occur within a group of modest size. One of my own studies made in 1958 revealed that most of my scientific colleagues in all fields of science learned of the work particularly significant to them to the development of their own investigations through hearsay or through chance. The invisible college, however, is implicitly a policy of exclusion and a tacit admission of defeat. The accustomed channels of publication are too slow and too gorged with old and new information to be used effectively. We are drowning in seas of paper. The second limiting factor in the growth of science is closely allied to the first one. It is the ever-increasing specialization of the modern scientist who must restrict his energies to a manageable area if he is to understand it sufficiently to carry on further successful investigations. This tendency of modern science has long been noted. It becomes steadily intensified as the volume of scientific knowledge increases. Francis Bacon divided scientists into two classes, the pioneers who dig, who mine, and the smiths who refine and hammer. It is all too evident that in the 20th century we have produced enormous numbers of pioneers, but very few smiths. Yet it is the smiths who construct the great unifying theories, such as the periodic law of the elements or the atomic numbers, the electromagnetic theory or the cell theory, the germ theory of disease or the theory of organic evolution, to mention a few of the magnificent achievements of the 19th century. It is well recognized that many, if not most, scientific breakthroughs come about when the techniques and concepts of quite different scientific fields are brought together in an original synthesis. The increasing narrowness of specialization tends to reduce the probability that this will happen. Too many scientists nowadays have blinders over their eyes and can see only straight ahead. What excellent diggers they are. But where are the smiths who must refine and hammer, create alloys, fashion a meaningful hole for the young blood coming into science in each generation? The mountains of mined ore accumulate, as Bacon might have put it, around the mouths of the mines, but nothing is done with most of it. It lies there useless until it is buried by fresh mountains of ore. And perhaps someday all scientists will need to do is to re-exhume what has been previously discovered in order to fit it into the constructed edifice of science. The third limiting factor in the growth of science I take to be the rapid rate of educational obsolescence, which is imposed upon us by the growth of science, technology, and change in human society. In about 8 years, an education in science must be thoroughly renewed, extended, and reorganized, or its possessor is beyond hope as a practitioner. If applied science and change in the character of human society are subject to a doubling time of a generation, say 30 years, then all curricula should be reformed and all patterns of education remade completely within the same period. Our schools and universities nevertheless continue to plan for an education that is crammed into the first 20 or 25 years of a person's life. Nothing short of the substitution of lifelong formal educative processes combined with professional work can meet the demands of our new technological society. The effects of educational desuetude are perhaps most dramatic in the examples of the physician and the teacher. What is necessary for both these groups and others in like straits is first never to lose the habit of study and learning, and second to be granted the time and financial support in the form of frequent, perhaps short leaves of absence to undertake the necessary renewal of their education. I'm convinced, fully convinced, President Wood, that the typical sabbatical of the university comes at too great an interval for our present rate of technological and social change. A regular cycle of mandatory leaves, regarded as an essential part of one's professional duty and paid for as such, is essential. Finally, the colleges and universities must begin to revise their programs so as to provide fully adequate and appropriate renewal of education for professional people, or else some new institution must be devised to fill this gap. What should I say then of our lawyers and representatives in government and our congressmen? In an age of science, when the gravest kinds of decisions growing out of altered social patterns and technological changes must be made, I think that this professional group in our society also needs to pay heed to the need for repeated retraining and re-education. That is because we see as a fourth limiting factor in the growth of science the long-term unanticipated side effects of the introduction of insufficiently tested technological developments into our social and political economy. The hope of immediate gain too often clouds our vision of consequences. Even laudable motives may conspire to produce disaster. The conquest of infectious disease leads to an explosive increase in the world's population because there is no immediate compensatory reduction in the birth rate. More convenient motor transportation produces smog. Denser populations aggravate water pollution and generate psychological stress, and unrest in our urban centers. As the peoples of the world become ever more aware of the destruction of their environment and the compaction of teeming populations into miserable urban masses, as with dismay they begin to recognize the loss of the beauty of nature through the encroachments of human industry and technology, it seems natural that they will turn against the forces they will hold responsible. I predict more and more massive resistance to technological change. I predict in equal measure a growing hostility to science, which will be held accountable, and a dwindling measure of financial and social support. Hence the fifth, perhaps final, limiting factor in the growth of science, the psychological resistance and restricted support of a population inadequately educated in the public understanding of science and militantly opposed to it because of its identification with the technological annihilation of the environment. These consequences are only to be avoided by sufficient foresight and effort on the part of the scientific community itself. I've thus come to the conclusion that what each country needs, more than anything else, is a new type of agency, whether governmental or private, I would not say. An agency to study as effectively as possible the long-term side effects of new technological developments before they are permitted to be introduced into our complex social organization. Many recent environmental, economic, and medical disasters could have been avoided by applying what knowledge we already possess or by making some further, more extensive tests. There was no need for the thalidomide tragedy. There was no need for the Santa Barbara oil damage to the beaches and ocean life. There is no need for the best agricultural land in the United States to be used up for housing development, spreading mile on mile without open spaces for trees and recreation. And if you want to see what I mean, just come and visit Suffolk County on Long Island. Man is a social animal living in a complex environment. He ignores the balance between his own population and the nature and resources of his environment at his mortal peril. Nature's cycles are mighty, but often delicately subject to overthrow, and civilizations before now have destroyed themselves through waste, ignorance, and folly. All is now repeated on a far grander, worldwide scale as man seizes the powers of the gods and wields them, he strides forward into the gutter demerald. A particularly glaring example of such failure to look ahead to the probable consequences of a technological change is the sequence of events following completion of the Aswan High Dam in Egypt. We need say nothing of the consequences of shifting the agricultural pattern of an ancient land from its dependence upon the annual flooding of the Nile to dependence upon irrigation. Less generally known is a catastrophic effect upon the sardine fisheries of the eastern Mediterranean, since these little fishes have evidently depended for their abundance upon the annual charge of rich organic matter entering the sea when the river flooded. Organic matter which led to a prolific growth of the marine plant and animal plankton upon which the sardines feed. Another dangerous consequence of the Aswan Dam has been the rapid spread through the population of infection with parasitic blood flukes or schistosomes carried by snails as intermediate hosts. As in Rhodesia, following construction of the great dams there, debilitating and often fatal schistosomiasis has spread rapidly. A third inevitable consequence, which seems little regarded by the builders of dams, is the relatively brief life of the reservoir impounding the irrigation waters. When a river carries a heavy burden of silt, as is so generally the case in arid lands, the reservoir fills up with mud in a few years. Lake Mead is already about half full of sediment. The Aswan Reservoir will have a very limited life in terms of the stretch of human history. What is to happen when the reservoir is filled and no longer contains a large volume of water either for irrigation or recreation? No effective means of flushing out the reservoirs has been devised. Do we then blow up the dams and later rebuild them? What happens to our agriculture in the meantime, after it has been transformed to depend upon irrigation? Have we any engineers thinking about the long-range effects, the ramifying side effects of dams? This is why the environmental scientists of today insist that a full systems approach must be taken to any aspect of technological assessment. No piecemeal limited engineering or physical-chemical approach can suffice. The biological, the psychological, and socio-cultural aspects must be introduced in the analysis as well, and long-range economic aspects cannot be ignored in the prospect of immediate gain. Can these perils be avoided? Our ideal is a people adjusted to its own land and its resources, daily increasing its richness of life through the applications of science and technology to its needs. These needs for each nation are unique. They grow out of its past as well as its present. They are shaped by its culture and its ideals as well as its material resources. As in the evolution of an animal species, its various aspects must change in consonance with each other. For too great a change in one respect, too little in another, may lead to extinction. For such development to take place in the future crowded technological world, we need a true systems analysis of needs, possibilities, and consequences. The national agencies I propose for each country are needed to relate the factors of change inherent in scientific discovery and education to the whole system of a people living in its homeland and to plan intelligently for its future well-being. These agencies must grapple with the accumulation and integration and organization of scientific knowledge. They must combat the narrowness of the individual specialized scientist and engineer. They must plan ways and means of overcoming educational obsolescence. Above all, they must determine the way to avoid the insidious effects of technology based only on immediate interest. International agencies of like nature must be created to deal with problems of worldwide scope, the mounting accumulation of DDT, the pollution of seas and atmosphere, the threat of radioactive waste, and of course, population pressure, and the ultimate peril of nuclear war. The planned utopia may be a delusion, but without some scientific analysis and foresight applied as fully as possible to the charting of the future, man obviously courts disaster. There is perhaps still sufficient time in which to act. In just 150 years, and mostly in the immediately past 50 years, science and technology have wrought spectacular changes in human life. When, with Kenneth Timon in a recent editorial in Science, we consider science as an instrument of service, we may indeed be inclined to discount the Jeremiads and predict the glorious continued growth of science and vast, exciting new technological developments as we enter the 21st century. Yet never have the social problems of man seemed so critical and so vast. Never has the aim of the scientist always to seek the truth for its own sake seemed so out of joint with the search of man for values he is often unable to state, but which he recognizes lie beyond the ease and the material riches promised him by science. Science has created a new world. Man himself remains essentially the same as 100,000 years ago, both in genetic endowment and over much of the earth in actual realization of his potentialities. Save for his accumulated capital of knowledge, passed on through education. Save for the material capital of civilization which he may utilize. And save for the broadened vision of himself and his fellow beings within the universe. He remains in his emotions, his thought processes, and his desires, no different from the first man who grew grain and domesticated cattle, no different from the Cro-Magnon cave painters, perhaps no different even from the first man who had ceased to be apes and who made tools and weapons and controlled the use of fire. The bitter truth is that man has made a world that seems to be propelled by some inevitability of its own toward change into an environment which is inimical to man's own hopes and dreams. Science is indeed an instrument of service, but only if its course be understood and its technological applications regulated and constrained in the service of man. Science for the individual scientist is his quest for the truth, his tested method of reaching it by investigation. But science is also a social process with a history that reveals man's increasing dependence upon science as the instrument to expand his power and achieve his goals, and especially to mitigate his ills. As social process, it has not only a history, but also a future, one of promise and one of peril. The greater the power, the greater the dangers erupting from misuse. The more complex the machinery of society, the more readily a single defect may produce a total blackout. We have created a system in which only an understanding of the complete system will serve. In the editorial already cited, Kenneth Timon expressed the view that while, I quote, "In the past, we science teachers have stressed the fascination of science, the unity of science, or the power of the scientific method. It is time now to stress the role of science as an instrument of service and as a means of curing mankind's ills. Time to stress the hope of the future as well as the achievement of the past." End of quote. Well, I agree. But that is not quite enough. The growing hostility to science in our times has root in a supposed conflict of values. It is symbolized by the machine, which, unlike man with his emotions, desires, and goals, does impersonally what it is made to do, and does it so efficiently that man himself is caught in the meshes of a system geared to production rather than a concern with other social values. Yet everyone should know that a machine, even a computer, is programmed to do what men want it to do. There is thus no ultimate conflict between the instrument and the spirit, for the instrument is the instrument of the spirit. It is not enough that in the future the scientist should recognize his dependence upon society for the support of his work at the level of whatever increasing cost will be necessary as scientific exploration becomes more and more expensive. Society, too, will count the cost and weigh it against the benefit, though not, I hope, in respect to each individual project, but on the basis of the overall cost of supporting basic research in the sciences, for one never knows in advance just which projects will produce significant discoveries. Even the wealthiest of nations may not have funds to supply every biologist with an electron microscope, every biochemist with an ultracentrifuge and a protein analyzer, every astronomer with a radio or optical telescope of high resolution, every physicist with a Bevatron, and all of them with giant computers.